Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Gentlemen, start your playbooks ahead on Only a Game. Recently returned NFL players race against the clock to learn the plays before the games begin. Also, a look at what delights the NBA lockout might yield off the court and in the courtroom. The Nation magazine goes sports mad for one zany week and the life of multi-sport overachiever Babe Diedrichsen-Zaharias. Also ahead, the streets of Schnitzelburg are taken over by dainty practitioners.
The key is to get as low as you can, make the stick parallel to the ground. When you hit it, it'll pop it up in the air.
What is this man talking about? Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week, we saw the NFL players back on the field as owners in the NBA went to court. While much of the country was wrapped up in following the resolution of a sports lockout that only claimed one preseason game, Billy Hunter, the head of the NBA Players Association, warned that an entire basketball season might be lost. Joining me now on the line to help sort all this out is Gabe Feldman, the director of the Sports Law Program at Tulane University Law School. Professor Feldman, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me on.
What are some of the key issues which caused the league and the union to disagree?
Well, if we're talking about the NBA or the NFL, the issue is really the same, and the issue comes down to money. And the big difference between the NFL and the NBA is that the NBA owners are claiming that they cannot afford to pay the players. They literally can't pay the players. In the NFL, the argument was more along the lines of the owners did not want to pay the players. So we've got a fundamental difference there that I think will dictate how these labor battles play out, and it's why I think the NBA is in for a much longer, difficult road than the NFL was.
Let's talk specifically about Tuesday's court filing. The NBA sued the Players Association in federal court in New York. They accused the union of failing to bargain in good faith. This seems an extreme step this early in the process, is it?
Not necessarily. Remember, the NBA players had already filed a similar claim with the National Labor Relations Board. And the NBA owners took the bigger step by filing an action in federal court, saying that the lockout is legal and should stay in place, and the players should not be able to dissolve their union and bring an antitrust suit. And that's going to be the big case. That will likely dictate how long this battle goes on and who eventually wins the battle.
You talk about both sides posturing. Is one side more legitimate in its posturing than the other?
I don't think so. I think this is a business dispute, and they are fighting over how to divide up dollars. I don't think either side is illegitimate. The NBA owners argue that they need money back from the players to survive, and that up to 22 owners are actually losing money. And their biggest claim, and I think the one that resonates the most with fans, is that many owners would say that they will lose less money if they cancel games than if they actually continue to play games under the current system. That's hard to say that's an illegitimate claim. The question is, how true is the claim?
The NFL lockout did not violate antitrust laws, at least according to the court, but the NBA is hoping to bypass all such debate by asking a court to establish that in the event of a union decertification, and if the court ruled that the lockout was illegal, and I'm quoting now, all existing player contracts would become void and unenforceable. I would think that would be a pretty good incentive to keep the union intact.
Well, that's really the interesting part of this lawsuit that the NBA filed. It's a pretty complicated legal argument, but it's not clear at the end of the day if that helps or hurts the players. I think it would hurt some, but also might help some who would all of a sudden become free agents and maybe be able to negotiate a higher deal. So I'm not sure that's a result the owners really want to get to. Again, I think that's just part of the posturing. But if it comes to that, we're going to see complete chaos, because essentially what would happen is the union would dissolve. The individual players would negotiate individually with the league. The league would implement whatever rules they wanted. The players would challenge those rules under antitrust law, and the players would all be free agents. That's a lot to handle at one time.
NBA Commissioner David Stern has made much of the fact that the average NBA player salary is $5 million, while the average NFL player salary is about $2 million. Given the relative size of the NBA and the NFL rosters, this certainly doesn't explain why the league is losing money. But does it affect how long the players in the NBA will be able to hold out?
It might. It depends on how much those players are spending. Just because you've got $5 million doesn't mean it's going to last long if you're spending all $5 million. And that's been the concern of the Players Association, the player agents. And they have alerted the players for the last 2 years that they need to start saving money. In addition to their money they may have saved, the Players Association has also stored away some money for them, and the players are getting some money back from an escrow account last year. So I think the players will be in a better position probably than the NFL players were. But one other factor to consider is that some of these NBA players may go play abroad. Also another option that the NFL players did not have. So that'll help them out too.
The more telling difference between NBA and NFL salaries might be how much of the money players ever actually receive, because there's no such thing as a guaranteed contract in the National Football League, and it sounds like the owners wish the same was true of the NBA.
You're right. The NBA wants to have the system more like the NFL, where the contracts are not guaranteed. So if owners make a mistake on a big contract, they're not stuck with it for the course of the deal. They can opt out of it. And what's a little interesting and ironic is that the NBA wanted their system to look a little bit more like the NFL, in the sense that the players don't get guaranteed contracts and they get a harder salary cap, and the NFL wanted their system to look a little bit more like the NBA. So their owners are trying to get, I think, the best of both worlds, and really what the players are doing is just trying to fight for the status quo.
According to the Players Association, revenue sharing proposals from the two sides are about $800 million apart. Do you foresee this getting resolved in time for there to be a 2011-2012 season?
Well, I think the litigation will help answer that. As of now, I certainly think the entire season is at risk. I think those numbers don't mean that much. I think what's the bigger issue is that the owners are really seeking a fundamental shift in the way the NBA's financial system works by implementing a hard salary cap. And something has to happen to give these sides a sense of urgency, something to put some pressure on both sides. Otherwise, we may very well not get a 2011-12 season.
Professor Feldman, it's obvious that you've given these issues an awful lot of thought, and you've explained them in an exceptionally articulate way, and I'm wondering if that's simply a professional obligation or whether you're a basketball fan. How much are you going to miss the NBA if it doesn't come back on time?
I am a basketball fan, just like I am an NFL fan, and I will miss it. I certainly will, but what I think is interesting, and what I think we've noticed with this NBA lockout, is the fan reaction is a little bit dulled compared to the NFL. And certainly the diehard NBA fans are very upset. But with the NFL, the thought was, if one game is missed, it's a relative tragedy. But I am certainly an NBA fan. And from a law professor's perspective, these lockouts are the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. From a sports fan's perspective, it's terrible.
Gabe Feldman is the director of the sports law program at Tulane, and he tweets under the handle Sports Law Guy, which seems about right. Professor Feldman, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
From Miami to Seattle and San Diego to Minneapolis, this week the National Football League's players were back at work. In Tennessee, several of the Titans reminisced about how they'd spent their free time during the lockout.
Hanging out and, playing a little golf. Hanging out with the family.
This year was a big Disney World trip, so did 8 days at Disney, so you can only imagine how that was.
Just went to the YMCA. I got a membership at the Y, so I think a lot of people in downtown Y are familiar with me.
You know, it's good to sit on the couch and chill out for a minute and just relax. So I did definitely enjoy my time off.
Like the players, the coaches took advantage of the fact that they couldn't engage in company business after the company locked out its employees. Or at least Chicago Bears head coach Lovie Smith saw that circumstance as an opportunity.
Well, we had a long offseason, I'll say that, but took a long trip to Rome this year. So my wife and I had a great time and kind of visited and hung out as much as anything and started waiting for this day to come.
Throughout the NFL, fans were also waiting for the day when they would learn that the season would transpire as planned. In Foxborough, Massachusetts, fans of the New England Patriots crowded into the bleachers beside the practice field and spilled over onto the hillside behind the end zone. A young fellow named Craig saw attendance at training camp as part of his own preseason preparation.
I mean, we're just huge fans. Getting even the slightest piece of this team right now is pumping me up. We just come here to get pumped up for the season.
Picnicking on the grass beside the field, Sylvia Nolette and her daughter Shannon, both dressed in Pats jerseys, were grateful for the proximity to the players during training camp.
I just enjoy seeing them this close instead of when you go to a normal game, you're way up there and there. It's more like watching high school football right now.
Now that's an interesting comparison. I don't think I've ever heard the NFL compared to high school football. That's very cool.
You can see them. They're close, so it's cool.
Like the fans, the players were appreciative of the return to business as usual, or as usual as the relationship between pro football players and their fans can be. Pats tight end Rob Gronkowski was happy to be performing for an audience.
The fans are great. We appreciate all their support, and we love going out there and playing for them. And, I mean, it can't be no more fun kids going wild for your autograph after, so that's cool too.
Of course, training camp, even training camp convened in the wake of a four-month lockout, is not all applause and autograph signing. Besides having to work themselves into game shape, normally players must learn or relearn the thick book of plays particular to each team. Many of the offensive plays and defensive alignments feature multiple variations, each requiring adjustments on the part of several players. Those who don't know the playbook well enough to recognize how their obligations have changed when the quarterback changes the play at the line of scrimmage can look foolish when they miss a blocking assignment or step to the right when they're supposed to have gone left. Cody Grimm of the Tampa Bay Bucks acknowledges that the challenge can be daunting, especially after the lockout.
Everything seems like it's in fast forward, to tell you the truth. Takes a little bit more time studying. Thankfully, I'm not a rookie again this year, but yeah, everything's crammed with stuff that took us a week or two to put in during OTAs and mini camps we have to install in 2 days. So everything's kind of in fast forward right now, and you just got to do everything you can to try to keep up.
Grimm is in his second season with the Bucks, but the challenge to learn the playbook quickly is not limited to less experienced players. Wide receiver Michael Spurlock is entering his fourth NFL season, and in this abbreviated preseason, he's had to create study halls whenever he can.
It's work away from work. We take our lunch period or whatever block of time that we have free, and we take that time because this is our job. This is the way we make our money. This is the way we feed our family. So when we hit the field, we don't want to be at the back of the group. We want to be at the front of the group. We want to be the leaders of this team. So in order to do that, you have to put your time in to where no matter if you're practicing or not, when that time comes, you're up to speed with everybody else.
Michael Spurlock and the rest of the players in the NFL will get an opportunity to demonstrate how well they've done their homework very shortly. 10 teams will play preseason games on Thursday, and 10 more will be in action on Friday. The regular season will open on September 8th when the New Orleans Saints face the Packers in Green Bay. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Whether you call it doga or doga, it's a happening thing in Florida, where instructor Susie Teitelman holds classes for two-legged enthusiasts and their four-legged partners. When you feel good, they feel good, Ms. Teitelman says. They want to be around your goodness. We chant together to feel the vibrations. Then we start moving into twists and turns. Though the dogs have not actually said they enjoy such gyrations, Susie Teitelman cannot imagine that it is otherwise. They're getting touched. They're getting love, she says, and everybody needs to be hanging upside down. Not only that, according to Ms. Teitelman, the regimen need not be limited to dogs. It definitely works with cats, she says, and when I do downward dog, my bird comes over. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a new biography of perhaps the greatest female athlete of all time. But first, this week, for only the second time in its 146-year history, The Nation has produced an issue largely devoted to our games. To nobody's surprise, it's titled Sports Views from Left Field. Joining me now to discuss The Nation's take on athletes, their employers, and their impact on the rest of us is Dave Zirin, guest editor of the issue. Dave, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, great to be here, Bill.
And we're also joined by Sherry Wolf, whose article, America's Deepest Closet, is part of the package. Sherry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dave, you've been writing about athletes' games and their political implications for The Nation for some time. How'd you finally convince people there to devote a whole issue to sports?
Well, I'd be lying if I said it just took a cup of coffee in an hour. But this is something that we've been talking about, honestly, for several years. It's like that scene in the movie Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield, where after a long test he says, I feel like I just gave birth to an accountant. That's how I felt at the end of this. It was a long gestation period.
Besides some long and ambitious articles, the issue includes a number of short tributes to athletes, and some of them from unexpected sources. Ralph Nader on Lou Gehrig, John Sayles on Roberto Clemente, and Dennis Kucinich on Jim Thorpe. How did you go about deciding whom to invite to contribute?
To be honest with you, that was more like trying to kill a mouse in your cellar with a machine gun. I mean, we just sent out queries to an insanely broad, eclectic number of people, and whoever responded, we just went through it and said, who's got the most interesting things? The one that honestly surprised me the most was the contribution from Noam Chomsky, because Chomsky is famous for his dismissiveness of sports as a kind of profound distraction from what, as he puts it, really matters in the world. And so for Chomsky to sort of get a little bit wistful and romantic about some of his childhood heroes was, I mean, to me, honestly, it was kind of moving.
Sherry, your article points out that the majority of athletes in the four major sports, the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and Major League Baseball, have all said when surveyed that they would have no problem with a teammate who was openly gay. So why do you characterize pro sports as, and I'm quoting now, America's deepest closet?
Well, it's really extraordinary, isn't it? Because, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to explore the contradiction between the asphyxiating gender norms and the closetedness of all, you know, the 3,500 pro male athletes in the big four sports, and the evolving cultural consciousness that even exists among athletes and certainly fans. Even Sports Illustrated's polls of the fans show an overwhelming majority would certainly not stop watching or attending the sports that they love if teammates came out. So really, I wanted to explore that contradiction, and that's what the piece tries to do.
Your article mentions some of the female coaches at the college level who have discriminated against lesbians, among them Shan Hart at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Are you encouraged that some of those coaches, Hart among them, are no longer employed?
I think it would be inconceivable that coaches like at Indiana have been fired after an outrageous sort of McCarthyite atmosphere against lesbianism happened over decades, literally. It would not have happened without the activism and the outspokenness of the athletes themselves, many of whom, I think 16 of whom, quit the basketball team rather than continue, not gay necessarily, but in solidarity with their gay teammates and just out of sheer disgust.
Bill, if I can tell you, one of the things when Sherry filed her article that my jaw hit the floor was a statistic she cited that 55% of recruits for women's basketball said that this was said in their living room, in the recruiting process, like you don't want to go to that school because that's a lesbian hotbed. And it made me think not just about people in these living rooms who aren't homophobic, but also what if this was like a young 16, 17-year-old lesbian woman having to hear this in front of her parents and how that would make her feel.
Sherry, the WNBA, the Women's Tennis Tour, and the LPGA, among other organizations, have all used revealing photos of players to publicize their sports. In one of the articles titled Sex Sells Sex, Not Women's Sports, Mary Jo Cain argues that this is counterproductive. Do you find that case convincing?
Absolutely. first of all, it's repellent to those of us who are women who enjoy playing sports. I stopped going to a local sports bar because the only photo of a woman is Maria Sharapova's rear end, who's not even a top tennis player, so far as I'm concerned. I was like, there's hundreds of photos of athletes everywhere, and the one female is of Hertzokas. I just think it really demeans sports fans.
And the genius of Mary Jo Kane, and she heads up the Tucker Center at the University of Minnesota, which is the only institute on a college campus that's dedicated to the study of women's sports, is they actually said, let's stop having this be a debate. Does sex sell women's sports, or does it just sell women's bodies? And let's actually get into some empirical data. So they did. They studied this for years, and but they came out the other end from all of their survey work was, it actually turns people off of women's sports. I mean, it's very good at selling Maxim magazine. It's very good at selling Playboy's Women of the Olympics issue. But it's very bad at actually selling the sports because it turns off the two largest demographics that consume women's sports. One, of course, obviously, is women. And the other, interestingly enough, and this says something about our society, is men with daughters. Women's sports in particular becomes a place where they can take their daughters and bond. And to have it all sexed up like that is something that repels fathers who want somewhere to go with their daughters.
Dave, I particularly enjoyed the short article by Bob Herbert, formerly of the New York Times. Tell us how his father responded when Bob, at the age of 6, asked Dad whether two New York Giants players, Bobby Thompson, who was white, and Hank Thompson, who was black, were brothers.
Oh, man. I mean, that story's so moving. I almost don't want to tip it off. I want people to read it. I mean, you just gave the great intro. It's such a short piece. Read about Bob Herbert. I mean, it's so moving, and it shows the way sports shapes our minds and the way we look at the world, the way we understand racism, sexism, homophobia, nationalism, and the way it truly is more than a game.
Dave Zirin is the guest editor of the August 15th/22nd double issue of The Nation. Dave, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, my privilege, Bill.
And Sherry Wolf is the author of America's Deepest Closet, one of the articles in that double issue. Sherry, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Babe Diedrichson Zaharias was one of those people gifted with the ability to excel at whatever athletic challenge she chose to take up, or so everybody writing about her assumed as they watched her win a track and field championship single-handedly, capture three medals at the 1932 Olympics, and become the headliner during the early days of the Ladies Pro Golf Tour. In Wonder Girl, subtitled The Magnificent Sporting Life of Babe Diedrichson Zaharias, Don Van Natta Jr. has provided the story of this extraordinary athlete, and he joins me now from WLRN in Miami. Don, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be with you, Bill. Thank you.
As a child, Babe Diedrichson was not an especially likable character. In fact, as you write, and I'm quoting now, she seemed to relish any chance to pick on black boys and girls. Was this a way for her to prove to people how tough she was?
Yes. She grew up on the wrong side of the tracks in Beaumont, Texas. And she discovered very early on that playing with girls was a waste of her time. And she wanted to play the boys and beat the boys at their own games. And she picked fights with boys all the time to prove herself that she was their equal.
Babe excelled as a basketball player, but you found that her teammates didn't think much of her. Why not?
Well, when she showed up to play semi-professional basketball in Dallas for Employers Casualty Insurance Company, she told her teammates, one woman that she met, she said, well, what position do you play? The girl said, well, I'm the star forward. And Babe said, well, that's what I want to be. And so she was a trash-talking Texan in every sense of that phrase. Long before that term was coined, Babe was a trash-talker.
Is it fair to say that as far as the participation of women at the Olympics was concerned, Babe Diedrichson came along at the right time in 1932?
Yes. Women only competed in track and field events starting the Olympics prior to the LA Games in 1932 and the 1928 Olympic Games. And in 1932, Babe participated in three events and became the star, the breakout star of the Olympic Games by winning two gold medals and a silver medal.
To qualify for those Olympics, Babe Diedrichsen won the team championship at the AAU track and field meet in 1932, and she did it without teammates. How did that come about?
Colonel McCombs, who was her coach on the employer's casualty insurance company, decided to send Babe up to Evanston, Illinois, all by herself to compete against teams of women of 15, 18, and 22 women. And that hot afternoon in Evanston, when employer's casualty insurance, that team was announced, Babe ran out on the field all by herself with her arms swinging wildly, and the crowd was just gasped at the audacity of this attempt of one woman to beat these teams. And she did it. Babe won five events on her own and tied for a sixth. When the day was over, she had 30 points, and the next team of 18 women had 22 points. Babe single-handedly won the AAU track championship.
Obviously, this was unprecedented. How did she respond? Was she gracious when she had to sort of turn to the second place team as the first place team?
No, she was not gracious. Babe kind of rubbed their noses in it, did a victory lap around the track. And then, you know, the press embraced her and said the American women's track and field team headed to Los Angeles was really Babe's team. And Babe let everybody know that. But the press turned on her. After her Olympic success, they were really quite vicious about her. One reporter said it was unclear whether Babe was a she, a he, or an it. And there was lots of questions about Babe's gender, about her sexuality. And those reports around the country by the national columnists deeply wounded Babe.
How did she respond to being wounded? Because she had been previously celebrated.
Well, how she responded is she tried to find a way to become a professional athlete in the early 1930s when there were very few opportunities for a woman to do that. She ended up on the vaudeville stage just 5 months after her Olympic success in Chicago with sellout crowds. But she walked away from it, even though she was making incredible money at the height of the Depression, because she just really wanted to play a game. And that's really the story of Babe Diedrichsen. Her whole life was a quest to find a place to play. But as a woman, she knew in the late 30s that hard-edged Babe Diedrichsen was not necessarily ingratiating itself with the American public, and she softened her image. She got married to a professional wrestler named George Zaharias. She began wearing dresses and changed her hairstyle, painted her nails, talked up the fact that she was a happy homemaker. And the public, for the most part, bought it. I mean, there was some sincerity to it, but there was also quite a bit of calculation to it as well.
You mentioned her turning to golf, and Babe Diedrichsen was such a successful golfer that in 1954 she was named the Associated Press Female Athlete of the Year for the sixth time. Would there have been a Ladies Professional Golf Association if it hadn't been for her?
I don't think so. I think the LPGA was created to showcase Babe Diedrichsen's great talents and her great showmanship. She would make fun of the people she'd play with when she did exhibitions with great golfers like Gene Sarazen. She toured during the early 40s and did events with Bob Hope and Bing Crosby. And it was a way for the promoters of the time and the sporting goods company owners to get together and create a tournament literally for Babe Diedrichsen.
She was kind of the Tiger Woods / Jack Nicklaus of her time as far as winning golf tournaments were concerned, and her last couple of wins were particularly exceptional given what she had gone through before them.
Yes, Babe got cancer in 1953, and the diagnosis was quite dark, and the prognosis was quite dark by her doctors. They told her that she would never play professional golf again. Babe believed it for a day or two. She actually tried to give away her golf clubs to a friend who refused to accept them. She had major surgery in April of 1953, a colostomy, and just 15 months later, Babe won the U.S. Women's Open by 12 strokes, an incredible comeback.
I'm speaking with Don Van Natta, Jr., the author of Wonder Girl, and you're listening to Only a Game. By that point, she was a good deal more lovable, I mean, even to those playing beside her on the golf course, I gather.
Well, she changed in a dramatic way. After that U.S. Women's Open victory, the third of her career, she dedicated the win to her doctors and also to the thousands of fans who had written her cards and letters and telegrams. She really became an inspiration to people with cancer, and she became an anti-cancer crusader at a time when very few public figures talked publicly about the disease. Babe Ruth, for instance, when he died in 1947, no one knew that he had cancer until after his death. Babe confronted the cancer in a very public way, raised money for the American Cancer Society and created a foundation that raised quite a bit of money, and she really was an inspiration. And her feats on the golf course after that major surgery inspired millions of Americans.
The Texas Historical Commission put a marker on Babe Diedrichsen's grave, a marker which you characterize in your book as, quote, engraved with falsehoods. What does the marker say, and what did the commissioners get wrong?
I think they got just about everything wrong, unfortunately. They said that Babe was born in 1914, when in fact she was born in 1911. In fact, this is the centennial of her birthday just this past June. They said that she was named after Babe Ruth, that her nickname came from Babe Ruth, which is a common mistake that's been made by newspaper men and past biographers. In fact, her family named her Babe. There's also a marble statue that's there that has a quote that it doesn't matter whether you win or lose, but how you play the game. And it attributes that quote to Babe Diedrichsen. It's, of course, the famous Grantland Rice quotation. And as I point out in the book, that is not a quotation that Babe believed in. She thought the most important thing was winning, and she had no taste at all for losing. So unfortunately, there are a few bits of misinformation at Babe's gravesite in Beaumont, Texas.
Don Van Natta Jr. is the author of Wonder Girl, The Magnificent Sporting Life of Babe Diedrichsen Zaharias, published by Little Brown, and the author joined me from WLRN in Miami. Don, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
She was a wonder girl.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Fortunately for Colin Furze of Lincolnshire, England, his mum has a big backyard. Otherwise, Mr. Furze wouldn't have been able to build the world's longest motorbike, which is 72 feet long and seats 25 unbelievably foolish people. Mr. Furze has managed to get the contraption rolling, but not without incident. It's almost impossible to keep it upright, he's acknowledged. It's very difficult to handle, and it would be hard to ride on the roads, as you need about 6 widths of road to turn. It's a real strain on your arms, as it has such heavy steering. But aside from that, it's a grand ride.
Born to be wild. Born to be wild.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Louisville's claim to fame, whacking the dainty. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
In the race during the NBA lockout to see who would get to a judge first, the league has beaten the players. What did the league say to his or her honor?
They're filing unfair labor practices charges with the NLRB, and they filed a lawsuit in federal court because the players are being uncooperative in negotiations toward a new collective bargaining agreement by making, quote-unquote, more than 2 dozen threats to dissolve their union and sue the league. I'm not exactly sure how availing yourself of a legal tactic is being uncooperative. David Stern, I know, is a brilliant lawyer, but he's got to know that this is merely a tactical delaying action, and these actions will get laughed out of the governing bodies as soon as they're seen.
As the NBA lockout ambled along, Clippers forward Blake Griffin found himself wondering if there was anything in his contract prohibiting him from surfing. And then the light bulb began to glow and he realized...
he doesn't have a contract necessarily since the NBA has locked him out. He's going to go surf. I think this is a great tactic. I think they should get the 20 or 30 most popular, most talented players in the league and have some of them go hang glide.
Skydiving.
Some of them skydive. Some, sure. Some of them bungee jump.
Trek in the Mojave Desert.
I think, you know, milking rattlesnakes for anti-venom. And we'll see how quick it takes the owners to get to the table.
The maker of the video game NBA 2K12 is set to release a version that pits Michael Jordan against Dr. J as the NBA lockout threatens to eliminate the daily updates that made the company's game popular. What? When the owners and players couldn't come to an agreement for a new NBA CBA, no one thought of the video game manufacturers?
To be perfectly honest with you, I'm amazed no one did, since they're very, very important to everyone's income at this point.
The NFL, of course, has returned to business as usual, more or less. Can any team be happier about that than the Green Bay Packers?
Well, they get their White House visit now, finally, after having been denied it during the lockout. August 12th, you might as well go then as in the middle of March. It's absolutely a lot nicer in Washington.
Even though everybody is back to work, the new CBA has not been entirely flushed out, Charlie. According to reports, the new agreement could allow the league to start testing for human growth hormone as soon as September, and it might also address the major problem players see with the current system, the fact that the league and not a third party handles appeals. So, fair trade?
No, because I think this is an incredibly intrusive test, and of all the tests that people have used since the war on some people who take some drugs began, that they've used to run over the Fourth Amendment, actually having a blood test is about as intrusive as you can get.
But if the players agree to it?
Well, the players agree to anything because they don't know any more about the Constitution than the people who want to take their rights away do. But it doesn't mean I can't object.
Bubba Smith died this week. He was 66 years old, and a lot of what I have read was written by people who want me to remember him as the guy in the beer commercials or the guy in the Police Academy movies, and I don't know about you. I think that's just wrong.
No, he was a great, great defensive football player and an iconic one for his time. Kill Bubba Kill was the slogan when he was at Michigan State. He turned out to be a very affable soul and was very good not only in those commercials but in the movies, but he was one of the great defensive players of his time.
In other NFL news, assistant coaches change jobs all the time, but I wonder how many of them remember to appreciate the guys they've left behind as well as Ray Horton did when he left the Steelers to join the Arizona Cardinals.
Yeah, he had a 1999 red Mercedes convertible, very cool, and he drove it up to the office complex and went in to talk to this guy, Mo Matthews, who serves lunch and dinner to the coaches staff at the team's cafeteria. And he says, "How much money do you have in your pocket?" And Matthew says, "I got $20. And he said, "Sold for $20. Handed him the keys and gave him the car. God bless him. I'm rooting very hard for at least the Arizona Cardinals defense this year because they're being coached by a really cool guy.
Those allegedly knowledgeable about college football have decided that Oklahoma should be the preseason favorite. Good choice?
No. It never works out that way. LSU is going to be the national champion this year.
Meanwhile, my favorite bowl game, the contest formerly known as the Humanitarian Bowl, because what could be better than humanitarian
football? Oh, they found something.
Has a new name, and it will now be the famous Idaho Potato Bowl. And how can it be famous already?
How can it be the what about the obscure Idaho Potato Bowl? Is that for Division II teams?
I think the courts will soon be hearing from them.
And the contract was signed, by the way, by the Idaho Potato Commission. And if that isn't a dumping ground for political hacks, I don't know what is.
Potato and commission. Two words that you did not expect to see together in the same sentence. Anyway, Major League Baseball is apparently investigating Yankee slugger Alex Rodriguez for allegedly taking part in illegal underground poker games, one of which apparently included cocaine use and a fight. According to one of the professional card players at the game, A-Rod wasn't there, but that doesn't mean he wasn't at other similar games. Anyway, how can the pro be sure A-Rod was not at this particular game?
Well, he wasn't at the game in 2009 where there was cocaine and a fist fight. That's setting a very low bar for Alex Rodriguez off the field at this point. He was warned about this before, and Major League Baseball, for all its floundering, is death on gambling like this. And they don't like you to continue to gamble when they've told you to stop. And Alex, it's starting to dawn on the people in New York City that they have Alex Rodriguez for 6 or 7 more years at $30 million a year, and maybe this whole thing isn't worth it.
Yeah. For the record, he wasn't at that particular game because it took place during the World Series.
Exactly.
So he was otherwise engaged.
It's a very good alibi.
There's more
in Alex Rodriguez's case in the World Series. It's often not hard to know if he's there at all.
Sometimes it doesn't show up. There's more evidence this week that baseball keeps more records than any other sport. Would you like to tell everybody what record Mark Teixeira of the Yankees has managed to break?
For the 12th time in his career, he homered from both sides of the plate, which is a cool record, actually. It's one, some of them I don't have any use for, but that shows you quite a bit of talent, actually.
Lots of baseball fans enjoy doing the wave when they attend games, and some of them probably do it in their living room as well. But anyway, the Grinch has surfaced in Arlington, Texas, to foil those fans.
Yeah, there's a website, stopthewave.net. The public address announcer puts anti-wave warnings on the video screen. Why the Texas Rangers are bothering with all of this in the middle of a heat wave when people should stand up and wave and make a breeze, I have absolutely no idea.
The soccer team from Japan was the somewhat surprising winner of the Women's World Cup tournament in Germany, of course, Charlie, your pick notwithstanding. Anyway, it looks as if the government in Japan has gotten over the shock and responded to the victory.
Yes, they're going to pay the young ladies $84,000 or 6.5 million yen as a performance bonus.
I'd rather have the 6.5 million yen. It sounds like more.
If I could have it in a box, that would be really great.
Tiger Woods returned to the PGA Tour this week, Charlie, with what the New York Times characterized as, quote, something short of a bang, but far better than a whisper. Maybe they meant whimper, not sure. Anyway, is that the best we can expect from Tiger at this point?
I think it's the best Tiger can expect for himself. It's a good tournament. It's an expensive tournament. It's one of the higher profile non-majors. And if he can manage to play on Sunday and be in something resembling contention, I think everybody will be happy.
Fred Casey boxed at the Tokyo Olympics for Australia, Charlie. He was known then as Fearless Fred, and recently at a concession stand at Main Beach on the Gold Coast, the 69-year-old former boxer proved that he still got it. You want to take it from there?
Yeah, two guys tried to rip him off, and he used nothing but his native courage and a golf club. And apparently he got a few swats in and saved all the money. Good for Fred.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
I said, hey, Mr. Spaulding, or whatever your name is. They call me the Hitman, the King of Swing.
You can follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio, and this week on Facebook, participate in our poll. Will the NBA and the Players Association work out their issues and start the season on time? Like us and share your thoughts at facebook.com/onlyagameradio.
What do you think of that? I'm going to whack you so hard you'll be seeing green. Well, the others may have tried to find a fairway with you, but I like to play rough.
Every summer since 1971, a neighborhood of Louisville, Kentucky has hosted the World Championships of Dainty. Reporter Ann Marshall recently attended the 41st such competition and met with the man responsible for the game's modern revival.
It's the last Monday evening in July. In the Schnitzelberg neighborhood, that's World Dainty Championships Day. The sweet smell of cotton candy sticks to humid air, as does the persistent, percussive sound of wood smacking cement. That's the sound of a crowd-pleasing hit. Dainty's a clumsy game that requires two pieces of wood, an open street, and some serious hand-eye coordination. The game's a little like baseball, except that the players use a broom handle to hit a piece of wood called a dainty. It's about the same length and circumference of sidewalk chalk, sharpened like a pencil at both ends. It's placed on a spray-painted start line. Then comes the fun part. Hit the dainty with the broom handle so that it flips into the air, then try to whack it down the street. The farthest hit wins.
Actually, 2 years ago, I hit it 80 feet. I got third place. So, I don't know. It was luck, you know.
That's Steve Cameron, waiting for his turn at bat. With a cold beer in hand, he stands among a tightly packed crowd behind police barricades. A spectator encourages the on-deck hitter.
All right, Donna, put your beer down and whack it.
But all eyes are on the start line, where the next competitor crouches down on one knee, aims for the dainty, but ends up tapping around it.
No, you gotta hit it. You gotta hit it.
Just as the announcer teases that this isn't a game of chopsticks, the dainty pops up, The player swings and misses.
He didn't get up fast enough.
Dainty's not graceful. Players flail and lurch to try and launch a 6-inch piece of wood into midair and then bat it as far as they can. And it can be somewhat dangerous. Orange mesh nets line the sidewalks for a reason. Just ask longtime player Roxy Bickle about the nuns in the front row a few years back.
I hit it straight into the nuns. All the little nuns that are sitting here, little sisters of the poor, it went straight into their faces. I said, oh, my God. Luckily, the mesh got kind of tangled up in the mesh. Come on, John!
So here are the rules. A swing and a miss is a strike. 3 times, and you're out. Players must hit one-handed and be 45 or older. That's tradition. So much of this is. For 4 decades, Dainty's been played on the same tree-lined street in front of the old corner market, Hauk's Handy Store, often pronounced Hawks.
Hawks is the gateway for growing up. I mean, you come here to get your ice cream when you were 3 or 4, and then maybe a beer or two after you grew up.
That's Glenn Bush, who, along with his brother Bob, stands behind the old Hauk's neon sign and talks about store owner George Hauk. You hear that name a lot on Dainty Day. After all, he did start the contest in 1971. But that's not what Glenn's thinking about. From behind sporty black sunglasses, he holds back tears.
And he carried this neighborhood when people didn't really have enough to get by. George helped us.
And there's no better way to meet George than the way nearly everyone in Schnitzelburg does, by walking into the store that his family's owned for 100 years.
Hi there.
Hi there. How you doing? I love your cane. It is so cool.
Well, that's a good weapon, too.
It is a good weapon. I like that. It's dangerous.
It's a Saturday afternoon, and the 91-year-old sits on cases of domestic beer, one hand on his cane's bronzed eagle handle. He stares out the front door's large window. It's a perfect view of the corner that was his playground back in the 1930s.
Years ago, when you didn't have money, you had to think up your own games. Yeah, Dainty was one of them. Shinny, Red Rover, Sundown, Piggy.
Dainty was actually borrowed. German immigrants introduced the game to Louisville in the mid-1800s. It's believed the Dainty was named for a similarly shaped ice cream treat. At Hauk's, cigarettes, candy, and snacks line shelves. A sign listing all past Dainty winners hangs right behind the register, tended by George's daughters.
Anyway,
we'll try. That's what Richard smokes.
Yeah.
365.
Karen Hauk says the Dainty contest revives the simple joy of childhood for her dad. But she knows it's her father and his old-fashioned kindness that draws such a huge neighborhood crowd every year.
Yeah, I was old enough to remember people in the neighborhood that wouldn't have anything, any food at all. And Dad would say, well, you know, give you bologna and bread and something to hold, you know, something for, especially if they have kids. But, I mean, even adults.
It's no wonder that Dainty is played underneath an honorary street sign reading George Hauk Way. At this year's World Dainty Championships, George parks himself in a scooter with a basket full of good luck coins.
Hi, George. What's
up, Chief? There's a wooden nickel for you.
Yeah, thank you.
You better have one, too. You better have one, too, honey.
But a few competitors, like Bob Bush, devised their own good luck strategy. He's on deck for his turn at the Dainty.
See, I got the secret. I'm going to go shake George's hand for my good luck handshake before I hit it.
Strike three. Good try, pal. Good try.
All right. We'll see if that makes a difference. Wish me luck.
Bob makes his way to George's scooter, gives him a firm handshake, and steps to the line. But his stick never even strikes the Dainty. 3 tries, and he's out.
All right, we're going to have to work on that handshake.
Becky Shane.
Thank you.
Behind the start line, a tall, stocky competitor, likes to go by Big Bill, claims he knows the trick. Don't hold the stick at an angle. He points to the woman at bat.
The key is to get as low as you can. Make the stick parallel to the ground. Like, see her? She'll get it up in the air. If you get the stick parallel to the ground and you hit it, it'll pop it up in the air.
This year, Big Bill, it's 57 feet. Not good enough for the win. That measured 93 feet. But the game isn't over yet. George, dressed in shorts and a green Hauk's Market baseball cap, hasn't just come to watch. He climbs out of his scooter and heads to the start line. Every year, he gets the final hit. The crowd is glued. He hits the dainty, but it rolls backwards. He tries again, misses. Then, leaning on his cane, he bends over, yanks the dainty off the ground, and tosses it down the street.
That's what I call a hit, right, Gordon?
The crowd wasn't expecting that. A band starts up, and George smiles as he hobbles back to his scooter, where a swarm of fans await. For Only a Game, I'm Ann Marshall.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Allison Gluck. We had help this week from Peter J. Mayers at WLRN in Miami. Special thanks this week to Paul Vitkus and to Only a Game's roving gridiron reporters, Bobby O'Brien, Yolanda Perdomo, and Kim Green. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view my Patriots picks or Ann Marshall's dainty photo gallery, which is not to say the gallery or the photos are dainty, or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from the dainty aficionado known to fans as Big Bill.
You haven't lived until you've seen nuns kind of tie their little habit up and hit the dainty. They kill it.
My friends who went to parochial school tell me the nuns used to practice with the rulers. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Well, I walked past just a, like I say, and I felt this hurt that would not go home. I can't expect that you're gonna see it my way, but you may not know the trees I've known, and I want them to put back my old cornerstone. I know it costs more money to shop there, but this was love, this was love. I know you had to pay more money, I'll pay money, I'll pay more. I don't care what the mall has got.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.